Well, I'm Sam Yamashita. I teach Asian history at Pomona College. And I was born in Honolulu and raised in Kailua. And I went to Mid-Pacific to play baseball. And then I went to college on the mainland and graduate school, and then have taught only on the mainland, actually.
Yeah. Thanks for telling us, but you bring to your look right now at the Japanese influence on haute cuisine.
Yes.
You've done, I mean, you speak Japanese.
I do.
I speak and read
Japanese. Mm-hmm. I can read Mandarin.
Mm-hmm. And so you bring kind of a scholar's look to this.
Well, that's the hope.
Uh-huh. What do you see?
Well, what I see is extraordinary Japanese influence occurring virtually under the radar. And I think people in the culinary world, in the restaurant world, were aware of it. But if you were to ask 10 Americans or 10 people in Hawaii even about Japanese influence on haute cuisine, they would say, "What? What are you talking about?" And it was really an incident that occurred around 2011 in L.A. at a restaurant called Providence, which was perennially L.A.'s best restaurant. And, you know, we would go there for our anniversary and, you know, other special occasions. We ordered the tasting menu, as we always do, and the first course was sashimi. And I thought, how is this possible? Sashimi at a continental restaurant. And I enjoyed the sashimi. It was kampachi, and it was wonderful. But, you know, I remembered that, and it...
And what year was that?
I think 2011.
2011.
You
know,
12,
that would not seem so odd here.
No. I mean, Japanese culinary influence in Hawaii is a completely different creature.
Yeah, and for us, Japanese influence, even especially in the way food looks, seems so obvious that we just never looked at it so closely.
I mean, people in Hawaii grow up seeing at New Year's a plate of sashimi with a plate of pan-fried Chinese noodles and maybe a turkey or a roast beef. It's not a big deal. But on the mainland, it was strange. It was strange. And so about 2 years ago, I thought, you know, I'd like to work on this. I'd finished the Hawaii Regional Cuisine book. And I thought, I'm going to look into this. And I'm at the end of my career, so my colleagues won't make fun of me for working on food. And I began to look at menus from haute cuisine restaurants in L.A. and New York City. I began to read food reviews. I found interviews of chefs, and I began to interview chefs myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I put all of that together, and I established, I think, what I call the Japanese turn in fine dining in the United States. And it's a complicated story. In the U.S., I date it starting in 1980, and it really runs until 2017 or 2018. But if you look at the bigger picture, the global picture, the Japanese turn really starts in France in the 1970s. And so I can, you know, talk about any stage of that. Of that essentially, 48-year process.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that it started with kind of an exchange of chefs between Japan and various parts of France?
It did.
In the 70s?
It did. It began when increasing numbers of Japanese culinary students began to go to France.
Was this government sponsored?
Initially, it wasn't. And the turning point seems to be 1970, when the International Exposition was held in Osaka. And there were lots of foreign chefs and foreign restaurants there. And people who have thought about this and written about this argue that the presence of foreign chefs and restaurants had a huge impact. So the number of culinary school graduates in 1969 was around 8,000. And then in 1974, it was over 16,000. And in 1979, it rose to over 20,000, and it's remained above 20,000, well, in the 20,000 range, really, for the last 30 or 40 years.
Hmm. Is that the primary way chefs in Japan are trained these days, culinary school?
It seems to be. Mm. But originally, Japanese cooks who wanted to do French cuisine would generally get a job at a hotel in Japan. And so the model is a chef named Nobuo Murakami, who got a job at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo at age 18, and then was sent to work at the Hotel Ritz in Paris for 3 years, from 1955 to 58. And then he returned to Japan and back to the Imperial Hotel. So that was the standard route. But after 1970, culinary schools became more important. And the most famous culinary school in Japan is a place called the Tsuji Culinary Academy. And they seem to have sent more Japanese cooks to France than any other school. They began sending their graduates to France for an extra year. And the first 6 months of that extra year would be spent at a Tsuji school in one of the cooking schools they had right outside Lyon. I think they bought or leased two chateaux. And then for the second 6 months of that extra year, these Japanese culinary students would then be farmed out to a restaurant in Tsuji's network of restaurants. And by 2010, that network included 500 restaurants.
Wow.
And so many of those culinary school graduates stayed in France. Many of them worked at French restaurants. Many of them opened their own restaurants. And I think around 2012, there were 8 Japanese-owned French restaurants in Paris. And some of them began to win Michelin stars. And I've been to one.
Oh.
And because the opportunities in Japan are limited, because the number of French restaurants and bistros has remained pretty steady. It's been about 20,000, been about 2,000 for the last 20 or 30 years.
So in Tokyo, you're saying?
In Japan.
In Japan.
Japan generally.
Mm.
So many of them stayed in France. And the big deal now is for Japanese chefs to work at bistros. And so there's a famous bistro called Clown Bistro that I haven't been to. I've only read about, but they have a hot Japanese chef.
And is that food Japanese influenced?
Well, that's the question that I'd love to be able to answer at some point.
I know, these Japanese-owned restaurants, French restaurants in France.
Right. I would love to be able to look into that. I've seen Japanese influence in French restaurants in Europe.
Uh-huh. Well, what does that influence look like?
Well, so at a famous French restaurant in Amsterdam, there were 2 pieces of katsuobushi placed on top of an appetizer. And I thought, well, this isn't very complex, but clearly there's some Japanese influence. At a French restaurant in London called Alan Williams, Chef Williams sous-vided a piece of bass with a piece of kombu on it. And I thought, that's interesting. And unfortunately, I didn't take a photograph of that, but I did talk to him about it later. I interviewed a French chef once, who will go unnamed, who said, Shoyu and French cuisine do not match. And he was wrong. Because at French restaurants in Amsterdam, for example, I had chunks of maguro that had been kind of pickled or soaked in oshoyu. And I thought of that chef when I had that appetizer. I thought, you know, the French chefs in Europe have no aversion to using oshoyu.
Do they acknowledge any kind of Japanese influence?
Oh, they do. They do. When I spoke with Chef Alan Williams after the dinner, he said, oh, yeah.
What is that influence?
Well, different techniques, ways essentially to increase the umami quotient in a dish. And in California, I've interviewed chefs who use Japanese techniques big time. There's a chef in Los Gatos, California, named David Kinch, who I think is one of the most brilliant practitioners and illustrations of the Japanese turn. He uses premium kombu. He uses four different kinds of kombu, four different kinds of shoyu. And I asked him when I interviewed him about his use of one particular kind of kombu from Hokkaido called Rishiri kombu. And he said, oh, yeah, I use it because it's wonderful for making ichiban dashi, the basic stock that one in Japanese restaurants uses to make suimono. And he said, but in order to use it, I need to filter the water here in Los Gatos to approximate the purity of the water in Kyoto. And that was remarkable. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I've studied cookbooks. I forgot to mention that I've also analyzed chefs' cookbooks. And Kinch's cookbook is full of long digressions on how to do a particular Japanese technique, or how to cut the fish in a Japanese way, and or how to mix dashi and butter, for example,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a soy butter mix as well?
A soy butter mix? You mean made with butter and?
Mm-hmm. Soy, shoyu.
Sure. Some chefs do that. I interviewed a Japanese chef who had worked at Bocuse's restaurant in Paris.
Hmm.
Either Bocuse or Robuchon, now I'm not remembering. But he said he saw the chef add a few drops of oshoyu to a vinaigrette for a langoustine appetizer. And so proof that oshoyu can be used, you know, in French cooking. And of course, that was a vinaigrette, so
yeah,
not necessarily butter.
But you're making me wonder what would it be like, you know, with balsamic, just adding a little something. Hey, so much fun! Well,
oh,
I mean,
it's great. It's been great fun.
Right. okay, so help me. Let's point the tip down and really get into this deeply. I have been talking to chefs as well since your topic came up.
Oh no!
And recently, Georges Mavrotalasitis was here.
Whom I interviewed.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And he said that when he opened his restaurants in Marseille in the 70s, there were always Japanese people on the line. There were Japanese cooks on the line, two or three.
Uh-huh. And that's when the Japanese wave to France seems to start, in the 70s. And so there's chefs, I think it's Daniel Boulud, who says, yeah, strange thing there. There were Japanese cooks. They would come, they would learn, and they would go back, and they would replicate our food. And he called it a strange thing. David Kinch, who was in French restaurants in the late 80s and early 90s, some very famous restaurants in Paris, mm-hmm. and outside Paris, he said, yeah, I never saw any other Americans. But the strange thing is that there would always be at least one or two Japanese. And so I asked him, okay, so in what restaurants? And he mentioned the restaurants, and he said there was at least one Japanese in each of those restaurants. This is the late 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to track the presence of Japanese chefs in French restaurants in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
And they were, you think, seeding ideas there as well as bringing techniques and ideas back to Japan.
Well, the other thing that happens as these Japanese cooks make their way to France is that the top French chefs begin to go to Japan. And what's important here is that there's a relationship between the nouvelle cuisine, which emerges in the 70s, and Japanese haute cuisine, that they seem to affirm many of the same things. And
like?
Well, for example, of using the freshest, locally sourced ingredients in season, And then respecting those ingredients and not masquerading their inherent flavors, you know, with vinaigrettes or with sauces of one kind or another. I think that's the most obvious. And these French chefs, when they went to Japan, would teach and, of course, go to restaurants. And they also began to do it a lot. And so a number of them, Alain Chappelle, opened a restaurant in Japan. And Bocuse did, and Robuchon, and Loiseau, many others. And when you open a restaurant, as I think you and your listeners know, it's a very time-consuming process that you can't, you know, appear once a month, 3 or 4 months out of the year. It means staying for several weeks. And so Robuchon, I know, would go and stay for 2 weeks. And he opened, well, he has, at the time of his death, he had 3 Michelin-starred restaurants in Japan, as well as many, many other kinds of culinary operations. I mean, the number is quite staggering. I don't have it with me at the moment, but
to be able to do so much at a high level of quality, how do you do that? Could he do it any place besides Japan?
Well, he had access to wonderful ingredients in season. He had platoons of French-trained Japanese chefs, you know, who worked at his restaurants. And Robuchon in 2009 is quoted as saying in an interview, "My cuisine is Japanese-inspired French cuisine." And of course, that's 2009, and in the 1970s, when Paul Bocuse was accused of serving food raw in the Japanese style, Bocuse said, impossible, absolutely not, because of the integrity of French cuisine. Alain Chappelle, when he was asked the same question, refused even to answer. So we go from the 1970s when French chefs are not willing to acknowledge Japanese influence to 2009 when Robuchon says, "My cuisine is Japanese-inspired French cuisine." I think that's really extraordinary.
It is. But I don't know, Eater article was saying that there was a kind of backing away from that acknowledgement of the Japanese influence more recently.
More recent, that's possible.
Do you think?
That's possible.
Because I look at it and I say, was there an underlying tradition of respecting ingredients to that extent and, you know, really stripped down food? Was there a tradition like that in France that they went back to? You know what I mean?
Well, I think the Nouvelle Cuisine affirmed that. And of course, you know, given the relative smallness of France and Switzerland, chefs had access to fresh vegetables.
But did they draw back on an earlier tradition to come up with Nouvelle Cuisine, or was it was it much more the Japanese influence on unadorned ingredients and terroir?
The Nouvelle Cuisine emerged before Japanese influence began to have an effect.
Mm.
And
would you say the Japanese influence was more on presentation? No.
I think Japanese influence was pretty wide-ranging, not just presentation, but also preparation.
Mm.
The use of dashi, for example, is, I think, the most telling. That is, when chefs use dashi or when chefs think about umami, what they're doing is actually managing the flavor profile of the dishes they're making. So it's not just the way something looks, it's the way something tastes. Say I, who did not go to culinary school and am not a chef, but that's my sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's just so great. Wait, now I've got to look here, see how we're doing. We're doing really well.
Okay.
For time.
Okay.
Okay, now, Sam, have we pretty much done that topic?
Well, there's L.A. and there's New York.
In terms of the American effect. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, Los Angeles becomes extremely important. Because in the early 1980s, You have two things going on. You have the emergence of California cuisine, which was inspired by the Nouvelle cuisine. Alice Waters opens Chez Panisse, I think in 1971, and Wolfgang Puck opens Spago and Chinois in Maine in 1983 and 84. And one of the things that Puck does, and Puck affirms the California cuisine and the importance of locally sourced ingredients, but one of the things that happens is that Puck hires a series of Japanese chefs. And so one of them was a chef named Hiroki Sone, but I think he goes by Hiro Sone, who was cooking at an Italian restaurant in Tokyo when Puck and his Japanese partners arranged to open a Tokyo Spago, and Sone was hired. And Sone had gone to Tsuji Culinary Academy. And so Sone is brought to Los Angeles for training. And when I interviewed him, he says, you know, I just thought Americans ate hot dogs and hamburgers. So being in L.A. was a real education. And so he was trained briefly in L.A.
Right. So, I wonder what kind of training, what would he be trained to cook?
Well, he was trained. He was trained. No, he was trained to make
pizza,
Puck style. That's right. Different kinds of pizzas, and he went back to Tokyo, cooked at Tokyo Spago for a couple of years, and then came back to Los Angeles, cooked for Puck some more, and then in 1988 broke away and married a chef that he had met at Spago in California, Lisa Domani. And they opened a restaurant in St. Helena called Terra. And they made a kind of Italo-Japanese cuisine with wonderful dishes. But
wait a second. So Italo-Japanese. I mean, we've got that here in Hawaii so much, and I'm just really wondering.
Okay, what?
It would be ume pasta, uni pasta, mentaiko pasta with, you know, nori shreds on top.
Yeah, that's Tokyo influence, but I remember those dishes from Tokyo.
Is that the kind of thing he
did? No, they were doing much more elaborate and interesting things.
Huh.
And the dishes that stick in mind are those they served at a restaurant they opened in the St. Regis Hotel in San Francisco called Ame. And so one of my favorite examples is a dish called Lisa's Staff Lunch, cuttlefish noodles with uni and with shiso and this and that, to which you can add handmade Sonoma natto. Natto? In the St. Regis Hotel in San Francisco. So that's the kind of thing that they were doing. And people who know Terra remember that Sone made a chawangmushi that had lobster in it.
Uh-huh.
And people that I've talked to always bring that dish up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so, but Roy Yamaguchi also graduates from the Culinary Institute of America in 1976, finds his way to Los Angeles and works at a number of restaurants, and he ends up at the best French restaurant in L.A. called La Hermitage, and he worked under a man named Jean Bertrandeau, who was a Nouvelle Cuisine chef. And Roy then is hired to cook at two French restaurants in L.A. Between 1979 and 1984. And during that period, Roy invents what he calls Euro-Asian cuisine. And he dates it, 1980. And so the advent of Euro-Asian cuisine, and of course, this is what Puck is doing. This is what other chefs in L.A. are doing, but Euro-Asian cuisine then becomes the vehicle for the Japanese turn in L.A. And so this is something I discovered when I was writing the Hawaii Regional Cuisine book, and I never forgot that moment, and so I went back to it, and so that's why I'm working on the Japanese turn now. Now, New York, an important moment occurs in 1985. There's a famous chef restaurant owner named Barry Wine who opened a restaurant called The Quilted Giraffe with his wife in New Paltz, New York, 1976, 1979. They move it to Manhattan. And it's the most expensive restaurant in New York City. And wine served what he called, he had a tasting menu, and he had Japanese customers. And they said, you know, your tasting menu seems very Japanese to us. How would you like to go to Japan? And so they arrange a trip to Japan, and they say, you know, we'll make sure that you visit some Japanese restaurants. So Wine goes to Japan in 1985 and is transformed.
Mm.
And David Kinch, the chef that I mentioned earlier, was working at the Quilted Giraffe in 1985. And he said, Wine came back, a man transformed. And Wine brought back, you know, plates and bowls and dishes. And he said there was a dramatic change at the restaurant. And it's at that point that Barry Wine begins to serve Euro-Asian dishes. And Wine, more importantly, says, you know, what I realized is that what we call the Nouvelle Cuisine is actually very French. And so he connects the two things. And so in a sense, he sees mentally what Roy and others in LA realized in practice. And in the wake of the Quilted Giraffe's transformation, you know, it was a highly influential restaurant, other chefs in New York begin to use Japanese ingredients. And of course, what's happening in New York, it began in the 1970s and it continues through the 1980s. 1974, four important Japanese restaurants opened in New York City. One of them was called Shimbashi, which was a first-class Japanese eatery, I think on 48th Street, and then Inagiku, I think in the Waldorf Astoria, and then two first-class sushiya open in New York in 1974 as well. One is called Takezushi, and the other is called Hatsuhana. And I used to teach on the East Coast, so I would go to these restaurants whenever I was in New York, and I thought, this is extraordinary, this is like Japan. But what made those restaurants possible was that Japanese fish and seafood generally was being imported. And by about 1980, I think there were nearly 200 Japanese restaurants in New York City. And so the restaurants are there. American chefs begin to go to them. And, you know, the famous chef at La Bernardin, Eric Ripar, one of the first things that happens when he gets to New York is that he's taken to a sushi restaurant. And so he discovers Japanese cuisine. He makes the mistake of, I don't know, not realizing that wasabi should be added and just shoyu and mixed with shoyu. He takes a big glob of wasabi and puts it into his mouth and never forgotten that moment.
Talk about awakening.
But a lot of chefs begin to use Japanese ingredients. They also begin to recognize the qualities of particular Japanese ingredients. So miso, they even use something called ishiri, which is a kind of Japanese fish sauce. You know, everybody thinks the Vietnamese and the Filipinos make smelly fish sauce. The Japanese do, too.
I've never run across
that. No, of course not. On the west coast of Japan, it's called either ishiri or shotsuru. And all it does is to add a huge amount of umami to a dish. And I had ishiri. I was in Kanazawa last May, and I made a point of having ishiri. Shiri,
mm-hmm.
but also called shotsuru, shottsu.
You didn't have it plain.
No.
A spoon.
It was mixed. It was mixed in a broth.
Huh.
And the chef, because like I said, you know, I'd like to try ishiri, and so the chef said, okay.
Huh.
And
is it really salty?
Somewhat salty, mm-hmm. but very very umami rich.
Mm-hmm.
And so that happens in New York City. And that happens from 1985 through the 90s into the early 21st century. And then I argue that in the second decade of the 21st century, Japanese culinary influence is ubiquitous and a given. And I argue, and I've gotten pushback, I argue that Japanese haute cuisine is naturalized. And some reader of a manuscript that I wrote felt that, you know, naturalized is too strong a term. And so if that's inappropriate, then I would say that chefs at haute cuisine restaurants are very aware of Japanese ingredients and Japanese culinary techniques. And some of them even serve Japanese dishes, like Maiko Simarusti at Providence in Los Angeles.
Is it, I mean, in a kitchen, a lot of different techniques and, you know, ingredients are used. But it is still possible to single out the Japanese ones, right?
I think so. I mean, it's easiest to spot when a Japanese dish is served at a restaurant.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
And so, for example, there's a restaurant in Los Angeles called Orsa and Winston, and the chef is a Mexicano from Texas named Joseph Centeno, who went to CIA. And so on his menu, he'll have chawanmushi. He also uses a lot of Japanese seafood. He uses a premium Japanese rice called satsuki rice that actually was developed in L.A. with the help of a farmer in Uruguay. But he uses satsuki rice to make what we would call okayu. But he calls it porridge. And what your listeners may not realize is that porridge is very hot in Los Angeles. And of course, when I first saw it on his menu, I thought, why is he serving okayu as a third course in a six-course tasting menu? And I thought, should I tell Chef Joseph that somehow this may be a little strange? I mean, a lot of us ate okayu when we were sick. Our mothers would make okayu.
Or, you know, we think of it here more often as juk.
Right.
You'd have it for breakfast. That's
right.
It.
Or you'd go to, go to have dim sum and have it.
A little juk.
Yeah. So those are the most obvious signs of Japanese culinary influence.
Did it work?
Yeah. Oh, the dish was wonderful. It was wonderful. But there are chefs whose use of Japanese ingredients is not obvious. Mm-hmm. And I went to a really wonderful haute cuisine Mexican restaurant and was tipped off by someone at the restaurant that the chef had a cabinet full of Japanese ingredients. I said, which ones? He said, well, miso, shoyu, I forgot what else. And so when I interviewed that chef, whose name is Carlos Salgado, whose restaurant was named by the late Jonathan Gold in 2018 the best restaurant in Southern California. When I interviewed Salgado, I said, so, you know, tell me, do you use Japanese ingredients? He said, yes, yes. And he said, I routinely add dashi to my sauces to add umami. And this is one of the best Mexican-American chefs in the United States. I mean, he didn't go to CIA, but he worked at Qua in San Francisco, this wonderful restaurant. Mm. And I think Salgado, I think he got a degree in computer science, as I recall. But his parents owned a taqueria, and so he grew up around food. So if you go to Los Angeles, be sure to go to Taco Maria.
Okay.
Salgado's restaurants. Hard to get reservations, but really wonderful.
You know, this is kind of, you mentioned Roy earlier.
Yes.
He had the creativity and the training to really be a star out of Hawaii. I mean, really an exemplary chef.
I interviewed 8 of the 12 Hawaii regional cuisine chefs. And one of the things that I realized is that they are great chefs because they're also very smart and very creative. And they're very good businessmen. And I think Roy has all of those qualities. All of those qualities. And Roy was regarded by some of the other HRC chefs as the rock star of the group. That's how he was described in 2009 when I interviewed these chefs. So Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Cool, right?
Yeah.
And so, wait. So Hawaii, how does Hawaii regional cuisine fit in with all of this?
Well, Hawaii regional cuisine could certainly be tied to the Japanese turn, but Hawaii regional cuisine is more significant for what it does for Hawaii.
More on that in the second extended interview with Professor Samuel Yamashita.